From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll look at some of the most memorable moments and defining parts of the Bucks playoffs run. A sports psychologist explains how the one-year Olympic delay might affect athletes.
When we think about how this one-year delay affects people, there really isn't a one-size-fits-all. It depends on you as an individual, it depends on your sport, it depends on your country.
We'll learn about the discovery of a wildflower that hasn't been seen in Wisconsin in more than 50 years.
For green violet to be rediscovered at all was a really big deal, but also because it was 200 miles further north than it had been found in the past.
And Bubbler Talk looks into a mysterious plaque on Milwaukee's east side. Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. First, when the Bucks won the NBA championship last week, it was hard for some to believe how far the team had come in such a short time. In less than a decade, Milwaukee went from nearly losing the team to dominating the league with MVP Giannis Antetokounmpo. The Deer District, which opened just 3 years ago, put a national spotlight on the city itself and the community. As a longtime Bucks fan, Matt Wild has been excitedly watching the playoffs and covering them for Milwaukee Record. He joins me now to talk about some of the defining moments and most memorable parts of the Bucks playoffs run. Matt, welcome back to Lake Effect.
Hello, Joy. It is great to be back. Go Bucks. Bucks in six. Bucks, Bucks, Bucks.
The Bucks did it in six. It was a crazy playoff run, and I think there are a lot of stories that in retrospect, people either missed or they don't quite get now. One of those is the rise of Bobby Portis. I was with colleagues during the parade and they heard all these people yelling, Bobby, Bobby, you know, and as non-basketball fans, they were like, what are they saying? Who are they yelling for?
I was at the parade as well, and it was incredible because you, of course, heard tons of chants of MVP, MVP for Giannis, of course, but I heard just as many, if not more, chants for Bobby, Bobby. And of course, that was this big thing that sprouted up around Bobby Portis, who kind of came out of nowhere throughout these entire playoffs. He was kind of benched for a while. He wasn't playing, and then he kind of came in on some crucial games, especially like when Giannis was hurt with his knee injury, which that seems like it happened a million years ago, and it weirdly doesn't seem like it happened at all. Another one of the kind of weird stories of this whole playoffs and finals. But yeah, Bobby just kind of like came in, and he became this, instantly became this kind of like Milwaukee, like people's player, people's champion. He was this instant folk hero that people just loved. And you know, he's one of these guys, and you see players like this, whether it's in the NBA or the NFL, you'll have these guys that kind of come out of nowhere and really strike a chord with people. And they just come off as like just hardworking dudes who, you know, aren't the, you know, ultimate superstars, but through hard work and perseverance kind of break through and become these great players. And that's certainly the case with Bobby Portis. It was great seeing him in the parade. He was the one holding the WWE championship belt that the WWE, I think they send out championship belts to whatever, you know, NBA team wins each year. And not only was he carrying it in an extra special touch, he had it upside down. So the W became an M for Milwaukee.
To some extent, it feels like Bobby Portis's story connects to Giannis's story in that he was this kind of unlikely superstar when he was picked for the Bucks. I don't think that anyone really saw this being his track, and yet here we are. He's just 26. He's won the MVP title twice now, and now he's MVP of the playoffs. And I think something that a lot of people picked up on during this playoff run was, you know, the world through the eyes of Giannis Antetokounmpo, these interviews that really showed his personality more than his athletic prowess.
I think so. And it's incredible, again, that Milwaukee, we have the superstar who is very relatable and very fun to follow along. And ever since he came to Milwaukee, it has been amazing watching him not only, you know, just discover these like little things in town and in the United States. Like, you know, it was just a few years ago, he's like, oh, wow, I tried a smoothie for the first time. What a great country. Yeah, smoothies. How terrific. And after, you know, after the game six and they won everything, where was he the next day? He was like in line in his car at like a Chick-fil-A ordering a bunch of chicken McNuggets or whatever, 50, of course, for his 50 points that he put up in game six. That was hilarious. I think after the parade, he popped up at like Barnacle Buds for lunch or something, which I just think is hilarious. And it speaks so much to him and how much of a part of Milwaukee that he is, that, you know, he's going to these great places. You know, Barnacle Buds is great. But, you know, he's not going to the fanciest restaurants and he's not going to these real exclusive places. He's going to, you know, Barnacle Buds. It's on the river there in Bayview. Like, everyone goes there. You know, as far as, you know, his athletic powers, incredible. But you're right. Just his philosophy, I think, for everything speaks so highly of him. And it's so great to listen to him. And I forget who it was. There was a sportscaster who said something really great about him. And they said that, you know, there are players out there that you can tell they're kind of really trying hard to say the right thing to the media about, like, oh, whatever city they're playing in or stuff like that. But with Giannis, it's so natural. Like, he just says what he's feeling and he's like 100% sincere. And that absolutely comes across in his interviews. You know, it's just great, you know, and he was saying that he could have gone to the super teams. You know, he could have easily won a championship if he would have gone elsewhere, but he did the right thing. He stayed here in Milwaukee and he did it the hard way. And he said that was the right way to do it. What more do you want from a superstar player in your town? It's just such a fantastic athlete and such a fantastic person to get to know these past few years.
Now, one of the surprising things that emerged during the playoffs was, first of all, an unlikely fan of the Bucks, but also, and I guess it's just because it was an NBA championship game, all of these celebrities who came out to cheer on the Bucks.
You're right. I think the big one that I think took everyone by surprise and was a real boon for Milwaukee record, oddly enough, was Sheryl Crow. I forget when it was, but at some point, Sheryl Crow, after a big Bucks win, kind of tweeted out like, yay, Bucks, and I'm so happy. And everyone was like, what? Sheryl Crow is a Bucks fan? Like, okay, go figure. That's terrific. And at Milwaukee Record, my partner Tyler, he put together a piece pairing Sheryl Crow songs with Bucks players and Bucks personnel. Put a lot of work into it, really dug deep into the Sheryl Crow catalog to put this piece together. And it kind of blew up, and Sheryl Crow got a hold of it, and she loved it, and she retweeted us, and she thanked us, and she was talking about it for days, and oh boy, that was real exciting times at Milwaukee Record HQ. But beyond that, you know, people like Lil Wayne, Dave Chappelle, I think, was at a game or two, Chris Tucker, Chance the Rapper, of course. And yeah, it's great to see all these folks show up. And I don't know, it's so wonderful. It does seem unlikely, because I think Milwaukee still does have that kind of small town mentality where we're like, oh, wow, like other people like us, other people like the Bucks. And it's good to have that validation. So it was great. Yeah. Seeing all these famous folks turning up at the games or popping up on social media. I know comedian Bill Burr, he's another big kind of Milwaukee fan and a huge Bucks fan. And so his podcast, he's just been singing the praises of both the team and the city. So it's just been wonderful.
With that in mind, you mentioned Chance the Rapper. He actually, I believe, promised to write a song about the Bucks in honor of their championship win. And there have been a lot of songs written about the Bucks during this time.
That is another thing that I love. I love sports novelty songs. It's a real passion of mine. I think it's the highest form of musical expression that there can be. And yes, we saw some doozies pop up during these playoffs and finals. Classic, Milwaukee homegrown rapper and producer and singer and musician Classic. He had one that dropped on the day of Game 6, which was great. It was called Bucks in 6. And that was fantastic. I know there was a Bobby Portis song, of course, no surprise there, by a group called G's Louise. I think they had reworked an older song that they had done for a Packers player and turned it into this ode to Bobby Portis. So that was great. But for my money, the big one and the song that literally has been going through my head for months now is by the great Eddie J. Lemberger. And that song was called Got Bucks Lust. I love my Milwaukee Bucks. It's a real sweet jam. And if you haven't heard it, find it now. Listen to it. It will be stuck in your head for 300 years. It's great. And it was hilarious, like, hearing that song on the radio. I know we talked about it for our monthly music roundup. And yeah, I just love when that sort of thing happens, that all these kind of songs that are both great or kind of silly pop up. And it just really adds to the atmosphere and it adds to the whole celebration of the whole thing. And it's exciting.
It did, in some ways, really encapsulate the energy behind this playoffs run. And I think for me, as I look back at the games, as I look back at this whole season, what I'm going to remember is the Deer District, just the thousands of people who were celebrating in a way that I don't know that we're used to here in Milwaukee, having that level of engagement for maybe any event, but certainly a sporting event in this way.
I think you're right. When I look back on these playoffs and finals, I will think of the Deer District as well. And it was one of those places where, not even for like any kind of coverage that I was doing or any kind of reporting I was doing, I just felt compelled to be down there for these games, whether it was outside watching them or for a couple games I got tickets to watch it inside the Pfizer Forum, away games to watch them inside the Pfizer. And you're right. This is obviously what the Bucks owners and the Pfizer owners wanted, obviously, from the Deer District when they originally built it. But I think even they were kind of surprised at the level of excitement that this caused. And, you know, pretty early on, they had to add like an entirely new lot to the whole viewing party area, which ended up being like the site of the old Bradley Center. It was this big gravel lot that they put another screen at the end of. And as more and more people started showing up for these games, they just had to like keep adding and adding. And finally, by game six, they had to add an entirely new lot across the street north of Pfizer with another screen there. So yeah, just being down there was incredible, just being in that action. And I will say, when you saw footage of it at night on the news or on social media, it looked absolutely bananas. And it was packed. But I was so impressed by how well run everything was down there that maybe other than game six did get a little there. I mean, by game six, there were almost 100,000 people down there, which was completely bananas. But for most of the run there, you could always kind of get away from the crowd and you could, you know, find a place to take a break and breathe. And walkways were kind of kept open by Pfizer staff and everything. And there were, you know, plenty of bathrooms and plenty of, you know, a couple places to eat. And beer lines were running pretty smoothly. Like I said, things maybe got a little out of hand by game six. But I don't know. I was so impressed by how well things were run down there. And like I said, it just, I felt compelled to be down there. And sometimes I didn't stay the entire time. But it was great just feeling that energy. And obviously, like I said, what the owners kind of envisioned and hoped for, I think it absolutely came true and kind of exceeded anyone's expectations. So hats off to everyone who was down at the Deer District, who was working down at the Deer District. What a fantastic place to be, and just terrific.
Yeah. Well, Matt Wild, as always, thank you for joining us here on Lake Effect. And I would say go Bucks, except the season's over. So I guess next season, go Bucks.
Yeah, I kind of I feel a little lost. I don't know what to say anymore when I sign up. So let's go Brewers. Let's go with that. Go Brewers.
Matt Wild is the co-founder of Milwaukee Record, which has been writing about the Bucks all season long. Wild is a regular contributor to Lake Effect, and you could find more of our conversations at WUWM.com. While you're there, you can check out more of Lake Effect's coverage on the Bucks' historic championship win. You can find a conversation with County Executive David Crowley about the economic impact the playoffs run had on the city, and an essay on Herb Cole's lasting legacy with the team. The 2021 Tokyo Olympics are now underway after a year-long delay due to the pandemic. For a group of elite athletes who plan their lives in four-year cycles, the delay has certainly posed some challenges. Barbara Miner is a sports psychologist and a professor of health sciences at UW-Milwaukee. She spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski about how the delay might affect the athletes and the overall Olympic experience.
That delay, it's not a one-size-fits-all, and how it's going to affect everyone may be different. That delay may be positive for athletes who were carrying an injury into Olympic qualifying in May or June of 2019. Or perhaps they were not physically or technically peaking. Maybe for a gymnast, there was another element they wanted to add into that floor exercise. And so the delay gave them the opportunity to work on that. We have an example with the US women's soccer team of veteran athlete Alex Morgan, who had a baby in spring of 2020, and the talk is that she might not have made the Olympic team had the Olympics gone ahead as planned in July of 2020. So those are a couple of examples where the delay may have been a positive for them. But certainly, as you alluded to, Audrey, it can also be a negative for those who were peaking, for individuals who had plans in life for August 2020 and beyond. Maybe they were going to retire. Maybe they were going to go to school. Maybe they were going to have a family. We see that with U.S. marathoner Alafine Tuliamuk. And again, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that right, but she was planning to have a baby and so went ahead and did have her baby, gave birth early in 2021, and now will be competing in the marathon as a new mother. So that could also have, like I said, a negative, and maybe it's a more of a negative impact for athletes in certain sports. If you're a marathon runner, the restrictions of the lockdown may have impacted you differently than if you were a swimmer and the natatoriums and the pools were closed down. Again, if you're a cyclist versus you're a softball player and you can't practice with your team.
As you mentioned, it's very much an individual impact depending on the athlete, what sport they're in, where they live. But since it's such a global event, I'm wondering, do some athletes have a competitive advantage over others depending on where in the world they are training? Because some countries are still gripped by the pandemic and some athletes were unable to train in the same way they usually would.
Yeah, that's a great question. So if you think of some of the countries that have had some of the most restrictive COVID policies, and I'm thinking particularly about Australia and New Zealand, if you could get what you needed within that country in terms of training and competition, or even within that state, because a lot of the states had border restrictions in Australia, so you couldn't go, for example, from the state of New South Wales to the state of Victoria. So as long as you've got what you need in your country, in your state or country, you might be okay. And so if you take the United States, which is so big and so diverse, and you can train in the desert, you can train in the mountains and not have to leave the country. I think in countries like that, you may have had a competitive advantage, particularly if you didn't need to leave to see your coach. But countries that had those more restrictive lockdowns, I think you could see a disadvantage. Also, as countries rolled out the vaccine, so some countries were less accepting or bought less of the vaccine. And so those athletes may have been impacted differently than, say, here in the US, where we've had a more successful overall rollout of the vaccine. So athletes can get back into their typical daily training environment sooner.
In May of 2020, there was an International Olympic Committee survey of more than 3,000 athletes or so. And 50% of respondents said that keeping themselves motivated was a major challenge. And also, of course, managing their mental health was difficult, as we've all found during this time. And we're not all elite athletes. But do you think that this is still going to have a big impact and challenge for the athletes who did qualify and are in Tokyo now? Do you think that motivation will still be needed to be bumped up a bit, or will this kind of catapult them into the normal training mode they are used to?
Yeah, I would suspect that motivation is not going to be an issue for them. Once the qualifications happened and they got their ticket stamped to go to Tokyo, I think they're motivated and ready to perform. They're trained to compartmentalize and block out distractions and do what they've trained to do. So hopefully the athletes from all the countries are feeling that. I think mental health-wise, we have all been affected, whether your job is as an elite athlete or your job is as a university professor or a journalist. All of our mental health has been affected in some way, and industrial and organizational psychologist Adam Grant has, you know, used this term languishing, that we may not be registering clinical depression or anxiety, but there's just sort of a blah kind of feeling, a little bit less able to concentrate, a little bit less likely to go that extra mile. So I think certainly there are going to be some mental health carryover effects for everybody. What's interesting to me, Audrey, is if you think about the way that you and I may have coped during the pandemic, right? So I might have eaten a little bit more chocolate, done a little bit more baking, that extra beer with dinner. And so the ways that we may cope for us, I'm going to count us in the same category.
Oh, I'm with you. I'm with you.
Not going to be a career killer for us, right? But those same normal, typical coping mechanisms, if you are an elite athlete or you're a dancer or something where you need to rely more on your body, those extra pounds and that lack of exercise can have more of a deleterious effect.
Yeah. And athletes, you know, they have to figure out innovative ways to stay sharp, both mentally and in their training all the time, especially during this delay. So within your practice and experience, are there common coping or visualization strategies for athletes and coaches that they've really had to rely on during this time?
Yeah, there were some really great things that have been done. So one of the things is, you know, you engage in strength and conditioning regularly. You're used to going to a gym and you have any number of pieces of equipment. And so I know some teams had Zoom workouts. So they had athletic equipment delivered to them, or they rented it and purchased it out of their own budget, and they set up their own home gyms. And some teams would have team strength and conditioning sessions. One team I know called it their backyard bulking. And so to maintain their motivation and to make sure that they were controlling what they could control, which was their physical condition. Certainly with coaches and athletes maybe who were in different locations, you can watch video clips of your highlights or some of the things that you're working on. So you can talk through those. You can maybe, depending on your sport, work on some of those closed skills, certainly with a coach watching through video. And then we can add in the mental component and we can get you to do a lot of visualization, a lot of mental imagery. We really tried to find competitive advantages, working on things that we might not typically get a chance to work on. So, oh, this is a great time to learn that different stress reduction technique. You've been thinking about getting into this sort of concentration technique. Let's use this time to do that. So rather than sitting around and like crossing off another 365 days on the calendar, let's try to find it in a competitive advantage and use this the best way we can.
For athletes, it's definitely a lot of a head game for their own selves and holding themselves to their performance and accountability. But a big part of the Olympics and athleticism is spectators, the crowd, and there won't be any in Tokyo. So how do you think a lack of an audience, fans, and real-time feedback impact performances?
I'm labeling this FQ'd, friends, family, and fans. And so whether it's been our local little leagues or whether it is Major League Baseball or softball in the Olympics. Certainly, athletes' ability to have their friends, their family, and fans has been impacted. And so I think that has been good lead up and good practice to what they're facing in Tokyo, because their friends and family can't come and watch them, and there are few, if any, fans there. So I think they've had a year to get used to that and to practice it. Now, let's take basketball, for example, and go Milwaukee Bucks, great city of champions. So a year ago in the NBA bubble, there were no friends, family, or fans. Over the past year, they've gradually opened up. And as we saw here in Milwaukee at the Fiserv Forum and in the Deer District, we're overflowing with friends, family, and fans. Okay, so they've gotten used to it a little bit, but now as they go over to Tokyo, we're taking it back to 2020, where there aren't friends, family, and fans. So they've had the opportunity to do it both ways. And so I think getting back into that environment in Tokyo will be easier. Interesting fact, I was talking to an athlete in Tokyo a few days ago, and she was commenting that the lack of friends, family, and fans made the Olympics really seem like just another game, just another competition, because they wouldn't normally get over the top support. And so this just seemed really normal, less stressful, and she was more able to concentrate in that environment.
Well, true. I mean, you're not going to get the same crowd for archery versus the U.S. women's soccer team, right?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. So again, when we think about how this one-year delay affects people, there really isn't a one-size-fits-all. Again, it depends on you as an individual. It depends on your sport. It depends on your country. So many different variables that can impact it.
Barbara Miner is a professor in the Department of Rehab Sciences and Technology in the College of Health Sciences at UW-Milwaukee. She's also the lead sports psychologist for the Olympic Winter Institute of Australia. Coming up in about 15 minutes, we'll learn about the history of the Milwaukee Mile, the oldest racetrack in the U.S. But first, we'll speak with the biologist who rediscovered the rare green violet in Wisconsin, a wildflower that hasn't been seen in the state for more than 50 years. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. May 5th is a day that Ryan O'Connor will never forget. It started as a regular day on the job for the conservation biologist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. O'Connor was surveying one of the state's nearly 700 natural areas when he spotted something that caught his eye. It turned out to be the rare green violet, a species that hasn't been seen in Wisconsin in more than 50 years. O'Connor spoke to WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Bentz about the significance of this discovery. He begins by describing the work he was doing when he found the green violet.
We walk through the property and we take notes on what we see. So we're looking for rare species in particular. We're looking to, in particular, if there are species that were documented there previously, we're looking to update those, see if we can find them again, see if they're still there, what the population size is, what the threats are to those rare species. But we're also looking for trying to assess the quality of the entire community or the ecosystem. So in this case, it was a community we refer to as a southern mesic forest, which is often dominated by sugar maple and red oak and basswood, and in the spring, notable for their carpet of spring ephemeral wildflowers. So people might be familiar with things like trillium or Dutchman's breeches, things of that nature. And embedded within that matrix, that's where I looked up and saw an odd plant and knew it was different, and it turned out to be green violet.
And it was last sighted in the state in 1958. Is that right?
The last record we have of its sighting was 1958 in Grant County. And it had been looked for before in Grant County at that location. But the location had been fairly compromised by grazing in the woods by cattle and was presumed to be gone from the state. People had looked in surrounding ravines and things like that. But for it to be, for Green Violet to be rediscovered at all was a really big deal. But also because it was 200 miles further north than it had been found in the past. So it really speaks to the importance of getting out and just spending time in the woods and prairies and wetlands and looking for these rare species that we think are gone, as well as other rare species that we know are maybe not quite so extremely rare in the state. But the more we look, the more we find.
So what does it take? I mean, just give an example of what it takes for that plant to survive. I read just in passing the importance of ants to the system.
Yeah, it's a really interesting plant. It comes up in the early spring, and it requires a particularly rich mesic woods habitat. So it needs like full shade. It will do best, you know, under really large trees. So forests that are, you know, older forests, old growth like type conditions might not be exclusively limited to that, but it's pollinated. And then the seeds have these little sugary bodies on them that are collected by ants, and then the ants carry them off to their burrows where they will then later germinate. But it also speaks to the fact that, like, then you need an intact, like, ant community. And I, you know, we know virtually nothing about ants, at least I do, but we know that that's an important part of the ecosystem for this plant. And for other species like that, too. Trilliums are known to be dependent on ants, certain species of violet. Same thing, but you need an intact like woodlot, you know, or ideally a whole larger ecosystem to support all of the functioning that any individual species need to survive.
There's so much to this. Your discovery points to, you know, how fragile our ecosystems are. There's a lot that can be found in state natural areas, but they're having a harder time surviving. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. There are a lot of what we refer to as environmental stressors on state natural areas, on all sorts of public properties, private properties that also affect rare species. So not just green violet, but there's over 300 rare plants that are listed in the state. And, you know, there a lot of them are endangered. A lot of people know about habitat loss, which is certainly true over the grand scheme of time. But right now, some of the other top stressors are invasive species, you know, so for green violet and other things of mesic woods, that would include garlic mustard. But it also includes invasive earthworms, like jumping worms a lot of people have heard of, but there's all earthworms are actually non-native to the state, and so that's impacting other species in that ecosystem. In other systems, things affecting rare species are a lack of prescribed fire. So all of our prairie and savanna species evolved with this over thousands of years, over millennia. And, you know, in order to protect our cities and farms and towns and houses, you know, we've really suppressed fires. And now there's a big push to try to get more fire back on the landscape. But that's a very complicated process. But, you know, the places where you tend to find these rare species are the sites that have been managed with fire, where invasive species have been controlled, either by the state, or by private landowners, by volunteer groups that go out and remove garlic mustard from the woods, that join nonprofit organizations to remove brush from a prairie, and all those things help tremendously rare plants and all of our common species too survive.
Where does the site that you found the violet, is that a managed area? Are invasive species an issue, a major issue there?
Yeah, the site where green violet was found was particularly high quality, or what we would say high ecological integrity, precisely because it hasn't been grazed, that there weren't very, very few invasive species present. And I think that's one of the reasons why it is persisting there, because it isn't facing a lot of the same stressors that are in sites that are more impacted by these things.
If you would describe a bit again about this unusual plant, about the flower, the look of the flower, and is this among, or is this like the top find of your career thus far?
Yeah, I think it'd probably be the top find of my career so far. You know, certainly rare species are discovered, you know, with some frequency, And I would even say that species are, you know, that are thought to be lost, but then are rediscovered. You know, it happens maybe once a decade even. You know, it's especially the more people you have out in the woods, you know, whether they're professional biologists or whether they're amateur people just botanizing or looking for bees and butterflies and birds. You'd asked about to describe green violet in that day a little bit. It's a really interesting plant because it grew in a big clump, and so I saw it from a fair ways away and walked up to it, immediately knew it was different. And the scientific name of green violet is Hybanthus, which is the genus, and the species is concolor. Concolor means the same color. And so, you know, in this case, like the flowers are basically green, the leaves are green, both the flower petals and the sepals are green. So everything is kind of all the same color. So it doesn't actually like jump out at you from the, like a colorful wildflower standpoint. The whole plant is probably 8 to 12 inches tall, but the flower is very, very small. When I saw it, it was still fairly young, you know, about the size of like the head of a pushpin. Maybe so fairly small, but the flower is really unique in that it hangs underneath the leaves. You know, we're used to things that you know, like might grow up like a trillium or a daylily and have a nice big flower kind of on top that's elevated, but these are very tall and hidden and kind of hang underneath the leaves. And so that combination of the way the leaves were, the shape of the leaf and the flower hanging under them, was really diagnostic. And I took a bunch of pictures. I realized right away that was really significant. And I even teared up a little bit just because it was, the sight is so rare, so beautiful. But also we have this incredible responsibility to care for these species. But also, like, these things are out there and we need more people getting out there. But somehow I was the one that had the fortune of being able to discover it, and that just felt really special. So yeah, definitely kind of the find of a career.
So I'm tempted to ask about your daughter, because of course that's such a cool story, but does she feel somewhat, you know, responsible for helping her dad, you know, zero in on this rare find?
Yeah, so my daughter gave me this note before I left. It was my first kind of long series of overnight trips on the state, and she gave me a note as I was walking out the door, kind of handwritten, you know, and she's in kindergarten, so the idea of writing handwritten notes is sort of like kind of new and fresh to her. But it said, "Dear Dad, I hope you find lots of rare stuff." And so she felt, you know, pleased to give me the note. But when I texted and called back, you know, later in the week and said, like, "Honey, your note worked. I found this really rare thing." She felt really like a deep sense of pride. So I told her she had a hand in giving me this good luck charm to help me find this rare plant.
Ryan O'Connor is an ecologist and inventory coordinator with Wisconsin DNR. He spoke to WUWM environmental reporter Susan Benz. To see pictures of the green violet, you can visit WUWM.com.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
This past winter on Milwaukee's Lower East Side, Eileen Hosmanic was walking her dogs with her daughter and came across something quite strange.
We stumbled upon it at the Green Gallery on Curtis and Farwell, and it makes absolutely no sense.
The Green Gallery is a contemporary art gallery that showcases artists from within the Midwest and brings nationally and internationally recognized artists to Milwaukee. But what Eileen found strange was not what was inside the gallery, but what was behind it. Inconspicuously placed on the exterior wall was a stately-looking plaque with bronze lettering, but the plaque and the way it read actually made no sense. The punctuation was off and words were missing.
And I was wondering if you could help me make sense of it, or somebody might hear this and might know what it means.
I visited the plaque, and she was right. It was strange.
"Near here, period. The original site and fabrication date are unknown, period. On the evening of October 28, 1892, period, affectionately referred to as, period, first settler, period, near this site, period, born, period."
Eileen had a couple of theories on what this could mean. One was that it was an honest attempt to commemorate a small community that had been forgotten.
It sounds like perhaps the community perished in a fire, according to some of the little clues on the plaque.
The other was that this plaque was actually an art piece.
It might be somebody's idea of a funky art project.
It turns out Eileen was on to something.
My name is Paul Druka. I'm a Milwaukee artist. I've been practicing for many years, inspired by the urban landscape.
Paul is a creator of the Near Here plaque, along with Berlin-based poet Donna Stone Cipher. And the idea behind the piece was to make people question the writing of history and commemoration.
I love plaques, public inscription, the way we write ourselves into the landscape. But I think it's good to have a little criticality when thinking about what it means and the politics and power dynamics underwriting it.
The reason it's housed on the outside wall of the Green Gallery is intentional. Paul wants passerbys to come upon the plaque by pure happenstance.
If you walk into a gallery or a museum, you know you're expecting to have a certain experience. And I appreciate and love that experience, but I also like meeting people in the middle of their daily routines.
It seems like the plaque is doing what Paul had hoped, meeting people where they are as they go about their day, provoking so much curiosity that they rode into their local radio station to find answers. For Bubbler Talk, I'm Angelina Moser-Salazar.
Support for Bubbler Talk comes from Milwaukee Mitchell International Airport. What have you always wanted to know about the Milwaukee area? Visit wuwm.com/bubblertalk to submit your question.
Bubbler Talk airs every Monday on Lake Effect. This season, we've learned about a mysterious bridge to nowhere near the Milwaukee River, explored the various statues and tributes to the late, great Hank Aaron around the city, and got the story behind Milwaukee's favorite pizza toppings. You can find all of those stories and much more Bubbler Talk at WUWM.com. After the break, we'll learn about the history of the oldest racetrack in the U.S., the Milwaukee Mile. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. The Milwaukee Mile is the oldest racetrack in the United States. It's hosted everything from horse races to sprint and Indy cars and, of course, NASCAR. And even if you haven't been there for a race, there's a good chance you've seen a concert there or even parked on the track to go to the state fair. There's a lot of history packed into nearly 120 years of the mile. Auto contributor Mark Savage spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski about it earlier this year.
Well, it really was in the early 1900s, and the track itself was built in 1903, or opened in 1903. It started in 1899, and it started out as a horse track, which makes sense. You already had a horse track there that was actually opened in the centennial year, 1876, and then the state fair grounds needed to be created, basically, and the Agriculture Society in 1891 bought that, opened up the track, and added this and made it both. It was both a horse and a car racing track at the time, so it was just like a picket fence around it, no big deal. The cars, as cars became popular, or at least started to become more interesting, and 1903, ironically, the year that the track opened was the year that Ford was founded. But there started being races, and there were races between cities for a while. Like there was one in Elgin, Illinois, and that they raced it like downtown through Chicago and back for a day race. And then it started being like 5 mile and 10 mile and 15 mile races. So a mile track made sense. There might only be 5 cars or 3 cars, but they would have a race for 5 laps, and whoever got to the end, and half the time it was whoever finished probably won. And as cars became more popular, there were just more races and longer races. And at the time, there were famous people that would run, like Barney Oldfield, and they would have match races with somebody else who was fairly famous, and they would race for 20 miles or 30 miles, something like that.
So we start off with horse tracks onto cars on the dirt road? And then when does the Indy car scene kind of come into play, and then stock cars?
Well, the Indy car thing is also what they were known as, champ cars, a lot over the years. And they started in the 1910s and 20s to appear, but it would be a one race here and a one race there. Then in the 30s, they came a little more frequently, and I think it was 39 when they finally got there and then raced up till World War II and then raced after World War II. And the Indy cars, outside of a few years that they missed, were racing up until 2015. And that's kind of when the track's popularity fell off, because not as many people like to come watch oval races now as they do to go to street races and road course races. So Road America up in Elkhart Lake, very popular. So it's just, it has fallen off in popularity as far as the ovals go, which I think is kind of funny, because oval racing usually is closer and there's more action. And at like the Milwaukee Mile, if you're up on the top of the stands there, you can see basically the whole track. So you can see what's going on all around. Whereas at a road course, you see little bits and pieces.
Right. One thing that was really popular at the Milwaukee Mile after World War II was midget and sprint cars. Can you explain what that is?
Yeah, midget and sprint cars are basically small front engine race cars. And at the time, the champ cars that Indy cars were bigger. And sometimes the dirt cars that they ran there were the exact same cars they would run at Milwaukee. But the midgets and the sprints were smaller versions of this. And everybody and their brother could make these in their garage. And, you know, Milwaukee was a stronghold of racing and of automaking and tied to the auto industry. So in this area, it was particularly popular. So people would go there and hang out, and it would be something to do in the evenings. And these guys were making enough money that it paid off for them to, you know, put together a car, race it on, you know, three nights a week or five nights a week or whatever. And I think it's kind of funny, because it was right about the Depression that kind of led to all this. And the cars, of course, were becoming more popular, grew and then kind of translated over into the when it became pavement and Indy cars getting bigger and faster and all that.
Yeah. So talking about the paved course, when did the Milwaukee Mile transition from the dirt to the paved?
Well, it was paved in 1954. It's a very flat track. It's got like, I think it's 9 degrees, a little more than 9 degrees of banking and turns, which isn't much at all. I mean, you know, people today watch the NASCAR races and they're all on these high bank tracks that, to be honest, when you drive your car into a high bank track, it automatically turns to the left because it's pushing you that way, the centrifugal force. You know, and they put the stagger on the tires and so forth. But this was really a flat track, and it was known for its speed and its danger. A lot of people have been killed at the track, a lot of drivers. And it takes a lot of talent to race too wide through a flat turn. You know, in the dirt days, of course, they would slide through those turns, and usually on dirt cars, that inside left front wheel will come off the ground. They three wheel it through the turn and slide through it, which is what was exciting too. And of course it throws a lot of dirt, which made the fans, you know, it was exciting for them to watch. So, you know, I just think it was the right time. And I think what it shows too is that how progressive the people running the State Fair Park were at the time, is they realized that dirt was popular, but they thought, hey, something new is coming. And if we want the people to go faster and more people to come watch it, we've got to do something. And obviously they had to build grandstands along the way and all that too.
Right. And then of course, it's meant to keep cars on the track, to keep people safer. And the Milwaukee Mile being here in the Midwest, I assume they knew that you can't race cars on there year round, taking winter into account. So have there been other kinds of purposes the Milwaukee Mile serves in the off season?
Well, yeah, in the off season, you know, kind of oddball stuff that you don't think about, that this was, you know, there was the racetrack, of course, the mile, then they had a quarter mile dirt infield track inside that. And at one point they had a half mile track inside that. And then, you know, I'm sure that maybe the Packer fans know this, the real diehards, but there was a stadium, a football stadium in the middle of the track where the Packers actually played football games from 1934 to 1951. And the NFL championship game was there in 1939, which the Packers luckily won, so we can all be happy about that. But you know, it's just crazy to think that that was you know, because they had bleachers and people places for people to sit, they were there. And then obviously after that, they went to Millard Park after, or then County Stadium when it was built back in the 50s. And especially now, because there's not as many regular races going on out there, you know, there's training for police forces will come and have driver training there, car control, and other people will come and have various kind of track days and just car racing experiences where you're not in a real race, but you're learning how to control the car on a racetrack. So it has continued to evolve. It's just that there's not as much racing as there used to be. I think it's cool that we've had such a strong history of racing. It's sad that there's not like an IndyCar race or a NASCAR race there now, but at least the track is still being used. And you know, the good news is that we can see IndyCars up the road at Road America still. So,
well, Mark, thanks for joining us to share a bit more about this pretty cool historical thing right in our backyard.
Right. It is exciting. I wish we had a museum there with all those cars there. That'd be fun.
Mark Savage is Lake Effect's auto contributor. He spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in June. You can find all of our past segments with him at WUWM.com, along with his weekly column. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll hear from the new head of the Fire and Police Commission, Ed Falone. Plus, we'll tell you about a mysterious illness that's killing songbirds out east, and what's being done in Wisconsin to keep birds safe. That's all tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect. On listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.